Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is freight and livability. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing your audio over the computer as well. Today we'll have three presenters: Chip Millard from the Federal Highway Administration Office of Freight Management and Operations, Dwayne Fitzgerald from Coca-Cola, and Michael Cray from the Atlanta Regional Commission. Chip Millard has been a transportation specialist with the Office of Freight Management Operations since March 2008. In addition to providing situational awareness about freight issues for FHWA staff and managing activities for the FHWA Freight Council, Chip is involved in FHWA livability efforts, working to ensure freight needs are appropriately considered while promoting livable communities. Prior to joining FHWA, Chip worked as a transportation and land use planner for almost 8 years for the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Dwayne Fitzgerald has been with Coca-Cola Refreshments in Atlanta, Georgia in many different capacities for 27 years. He currently manages a team of distribution route specialists for the Southeast region of the USA. He is the third generation of his family to work for Coca-Cola, and his grandfather was one of the original distributors and salesmen. Michael Cray has been a principal planner at the Atlanta Regional Commission since 2007, serving as the freight program manager since 2009. He was the project manager for the Atlanta Strategic Route Master Plan, or AstroMap, which was completed in 2010. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters. The PowerPoint presentations used during today's seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript, and I'll notify all attendees once the materials are available. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, please type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Please note that today's seminar is not yet available on the AICP website, but I'll send out an email to everyone who registered once it is available for credits. I also encourage everybody, whether or not you're applying for credits, to download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. We'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic is freight and livability, and as a reminder, if you have questions during the presentations, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. Our first presenter will be Chip Millard from the Federal Highway Administration Office of Freight Management and Operations.
All right, thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate the introduction. I want to thank everybody for attending today's webinar about freight and livability. It seems to be a topic that a lot of people are interested in, and I'm guessing that some people are trying to figure out exactly how those two things go together with freight and livability. What I'm going to try to do in this presentation is I'll start out by giving a brief overview of freight transportation for those of you who are coming at it know more about livability. I'll also give a brief explanation about what livability is for those of you who have more of a freight background. And then the bulk of the presentation is going to be discussion about how freight and livability have similarities, and where there's commonalities, provide some information about where freight helps support livability, and also some information about how freight goals and livability goals are consistent with one another. And it'll be tied in with the Sustainable Communities Partnership Livability Core Principles, which I'll get into further, more detail in the presentation. Okay, I just want to start out by talking about the importance of freight, both freight and livability, for the USDOT. As it indicates on this slide, freight transportation is a USDOT priority. It's very important as it relates to the U.S. economy and U.S. trade. It's a key component, if you're looking at the second bullet point, with meeting President Obama's objective to double U.S. exports between 2010 and 2015. Also, with livability is also a USDOT priority. DOT has been involved, as I noted, with the Sustainable Communities Partnership with HUD and EPA, It's also one of the primary, was one of the primary evaluation criteria with the Tiger Grants programs, Tiger 1 and Tiger 2. Livability is tied to increasing the quality of life. This next slide, I just want to talk briefly about freight transportation, give people an idea about with how freight transportation works in terms of the different modes that are used. This slide is basically a service cost continuum, showing the different modes of transportation. The modes that are shown on the left are, tend to be faster. They tend to be used for shipments that are more time sensitive or higher value. As you move over towards the right-hand slide, right-hand part of the slide, those are the modes that tend to be used for goods that have a relatively low value relative to their weight. They're not, they don't need to move quite as quickly. If you think about, like, for example, bulk shipments, coal shipments, oil, stuff like that would fit into this. And the key point here is that in addition to noting that certain goods, I think the key point is that certain goods tend to move by certain modes. If you have goods that are of high value or time sensitive or perishable, they're going to go on faster modes of transportation. They're going to go on air, you know, fly by air if it's something that needs to get there immediately. Trucks are often commonly used. In some cases, if you're talking about longer haul shipments, rail might be used for intermodal rail. With not as time sensitive shipments that are lower value, but they're important goods, they're going to tend to go by the slower modes that are shown on the right. And I think it's important to note that there's a lot of discussion that can occur about shifting freight from one mode to another, trying to get trucks off the road, that kind of thing. And in some cases, there are opportunities to do that, but in other cases, because of the types of goods that are being shipped and the needs of the people receiving the shipments or the manufacturers that are producing the shipments, goods are going to go by certain modes. So it's important to understand that. It's also important to understand that trucks will often handle the last mile of shipments, that you don't have railroad or water port or airport infrastructure that's located at businesses to handle that directly. So that's important to know. I also want to talk briefly about what livability is, and that just gives the definition on there. It's about tying quality and location of transportation facilities to communities. This includes addressing safety and capacity issues on all roads through appropriate planning, infrastructure design, and traffic management tools such as ITS technologies and traveler demand management approaches. And one of the key things with livability is to understand that it recognizes the unique character of each community. And that you need to have, when you're talking about livability, it can be, admittedly, much of this presentation is focused on more urban and suburban, but livability has applications in all types of settings, urban, suburban, and rural. And it's about enhancing unique character, unique community characteristics, and trying to maximize transportation options regardless of where community you're located, where the community is located. This next slide just shows you the six core livability principles that have been identified by the Sustainable Communities Partnership. And you can see there's the six core principles. And I want to talk about, go to the next slide, five of the six core principles, the ones that are shown in bold on this slide under the, with the bullet points, they either can be where freight transportation either directly supports these core principles, or at the very least where freight is consistent with the livability core principles. That although freight and livability sometimes can seem like they're quite different, freight is actually quite integral to livability, and even in some other cases, it's something where there's a consistency between what is desired when you're talking about enhancing livability and what is desired with enhancing freight transportation. What I'm going to do is I go through talking about the livability core principles and the ties between freight and livability. Is I'm going to put up the definitions for each of on one slide, the definition of the core principle for that particular area of livability. And in this case, here's the definition for enhancing economic competitiveness. I'm just going to go over them very quickly when I get to each slide. In terms of enhancing economic competitiveness, this is probably the livability core principle where there's the closest tie between freight transportation and livability. It's something where freight transportation is essential in picking up and delivering the goods that are produced and consumed in livable communities. If goods cannot easily be picked up and delivered within communities, such as restaurants, stores, and other commercial amenities within the community, if they can't receive their goods, the community's livability is reduced. So freight transportation is actually quite critical for livability. In addition to the goods pickup and delivery, freight transportation is also important for supporting many jobs, including many well-paying jobs within communities. And some of those jobs and some of those well-paying jobs are actually at major freight facilities that are in communities, such as ports, intermodal rail yards, distribution centers. They provide jobs. They also provide tax base. So it's in, this is where, again, where freight transportation really can be supportive of livability, and keeping the needs of jobs and keeping the needs of deliveries in mind is important if you want to sustain and trying to enhance livability. Land use and zoning is often a key connection point in terms of trying to enhance livability through freight transportation, not have it be a negative. This next slide just talks about, giving a specific example about the Port of Baltimore. And I just want to note, you can see the information at the top of the slide. Over 50,000 jobs, direct and indirect, are created by the Port of Baltimore. And there's obviously a large amount of tax base that's created by the port. And it's important to note that. But however, one other thing to consider is that many industrial facilities, especially those facilities that handle significant discretionary or non-local freight movements, they can face strong competition from other similar facilities. So the Port of Baltimore, in this case, the Port of Baltimore, they face competition from other ports along the East Coast. And they, you know, they're trying to steal their lunch, so to speak. So you know, making sure the port is able to be economically viable is important for the Baltimore metropolitan greater Maryland region. Additionally, the location attractiveness of some industrial facilities, particularly ports that are located on desirable waterfront land, can also make them susceptible to non-freight development pressures and non-facility-related traffic issues. The issue of, you know, oftentimes I think the term is used as gentrification, or just development of residential or commercial uses in this attractive waterfront land that you may already have an existing port facilities there, and it's very viable to the community, but this is land that's desirable. There can be some development challenges, development conflicts potentially that can occur there. And less efficient freight facilities become less economically viable, and that has a negative impact on jobs in the community. The next couple slides just show quick examples here with livability. And think about Baltimore's waterfront. Obviously, these are pictures, some of you are probably familiar with this, Baltimore's Inner Harbor. It's been very successful for the city of Baltimore as a tourist attraction. It's enhanced livability within Baltimore, being an attraction that many people both in the live in the area and also come visit Baltimore, they can utilize. It has some economic benefits, obviously has a lot of economic benefits for the Baltimore region. So there's a lot of benefits to what's occurred with Baltimore's Inner Harbor. But along with that, one of the things to keep in mind is, as I alluded to a minute or two ago, is that you have the port area development, the waterfront development. That's very attractive for different kinds of residential, higher end residential and commercial uses. And that can have some, that potentially creates challenges when you're talking about an existing industrial development. And that could potentially threaten the port's viability. In order to address that issue, the Port of Baltimore, or should I say the City of Baltimore, created a new industrial district back in 2004, basically meant to preserve or protect the existing, in this case, the existing industrial port-related uses and have limited residential and commercial uses in this area through a 10-year period. Again, trying to help preserve pre-existing economically viable industrial development and helping to protect the job generators within regions. We'll go on to the next of the livability core principles, which is valuing communities and neighborhoods. You can see the definition there for that particular core principle. And with this core principle, this is also another one where there's a very strong tie between freight transportation and livability. That this core principle can either be supported or undermined by freight transportation. And whether it's supported or undermined really depends upon whether or not freight transportation needs are appropriately considered in community planning efforts and community development implementation. Some of those latter bullet points on the slides about creating buffer zones between industrial areas and more sensitive uses, residential and environmental, the idea of having new developments, they have sufficient on-site loading or unloading, and also the street network accommodating freight. These are key considerations when you're talking about valuing communities and neighborhoods. You have to get your goods into the community. If you want to have a livable community, that's something that's desired, to be able to walk to different stores, different restaurants, and whatnot. But if you can't get the goods into the community, it becomes a real, with freight transportation, becomes a real problem for the community in terms of sustaining its livability. The next couple of slides show some of the challenges that can occur, some of the issues that can occur if there's not appropriate types of planning or thought in terms of when you have residential development, or not, I should say more broadly, making sure you properly accommodate freight transportation within the community. Here's pictures that are showing You have a pre-existing freight transportation or freight facilities within the community, rail yards or truck-related facilities, and residential development was put near these facilities. Obviously, that creates some problems for the community because you have trucks that are passing through the community. That's something that's not desired for the community. It also has a negative impact on freight transportation as well, because now you have residential development there, people complaining. You also have other traffic that's not freight-related traffic there. So it has a negative impact. By having some questionable land use decisions, you have a negative impact both on livability and on freight transportation. This next slide looks at it similarly, but it's somewhat different perspective, about not properly considering freight needs or existing freight transportation within the community. Here you can clearly see on this slide a sidewalk that's been torn up because trucks have driven over the sidewalk. And it's something where the street design, sidewalk design was really not appropriate relative to existing truck traffic that was in the community, for pre-existing truck traffic. And this has obviously negative impacts on freight transportation that you're driving over curbs, and probably more obviously has negative impacts on livability as well. I mean, having a cracked up sidewalk like that makes it harder for mobility, especially if you're handicapped. So that can be a significant problem. I'll just note one other thing. If you notice the yield sign on this slide, set back from the sidewalks, I think it's pretty obvious that they recognized it was a problem, but they built the sidewalk and the road the way they did. Now, changing gears here, a more positive proper accommodation of freight transportation as it relates to livability, a combination of curbside truck deliveries. You can see here where there's produce goods that are being delivered within, it looks like, an urban area. And because the trucks are able to park alongside of this and dedicated truck parking areas for businesses, they're able to easily deliver their goods to the businesses. That obviously enhances the freight transportation. It also has some livability benefits. You're not having double parking, so you have reduced congestion on the streets. And it also helps improve safety. You don't have situations with double parking where it's problematic for car drivers, it's problematic for bicyclists or pedestrians, where you have people trying to, especially with bicyclists and pedestrians, trying to move around within the community, and having trucks double parked, that becomes a problem safety-wise. So proper combination of freight transportation needs or freight deliveries can be beneficial for livability. Move on to the third of the livability core principles with the tie to freight, and that's valuing communities and neighborhoods. And this is something where there's a degree of consistency, but there's also, I went one slide too far, my apologies. But this last slide here with valuing communities and neighborhoods, I think the key thing to note is that logistics needs are often an afterthought in planning and site development review processes. And the important thing here is to realize that underemphasizing freight needs within livable communities can restrict freight transportation efficiency and negatively impact communities' economic vitality. Likewise, overemphasizing freight needs within livable communities, such as designing all roads to accommodate large trucks, even those that never or very rarely handle those trucks, can make walking, biking, and public transit use less attractive and convenient. The key is trying to find the right balance between non-freight livability needs and freight transportation needs to make it more likely the community can be attractive both aesthetically and economically. You're enhancing both livability and freight transportation. Okay, move on to the next livability core principle, supporting existing communities. And you can see the definition there about trying to find strategies for mixed-use development, land recycling. And the key point here is that with freight transportation, there's opportunities that exist to consolidate freight functions, whether it's on brownfield sites, pre-existing or previously developed brownfield sites, or potentially in some cases new sites. But you consolidate freight uses, especially in areas where there's a lot of freight transportation movements, so there are freight hub locations. You can consolidate them into specific sites, specific freight hub locations within those metropolitan areas. And by doing that, you're able to increase the economic efficiency of freight transportation because you consolidate those uses into one relatively small location or appropriate number of locations. And you also have reduce the impact on the community as a whole, because instead of dispersing your freight-related development at different locations, you're concentrating it at a small number of locations. So most of the metropolitan area, most of the community is not impacted as much by freight transportation. And I think a key thing to note here is when you're thinking about freight and livability is that intermodal, as it notes with the last bullet point, intermodal freight movements can be supported if freight hubs are located where necessary infrastructure is in place. And I should note with infrastructure, it's not just transportation infrastructure, it also could be utilities, but thinking about transportation here in particular with this presentation. We'll move on to the next slide. This is an example of a freight village or freight hub. This is with Alliance, Texas. This is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and you can see with the bullets there that there is various different freight modes, not only highways, but a couple of Class 1, which are the major railroads, two major Class 1 railroads in the western U.S. There's also good air cargo access with a dedicated industrial airport and pretty close access to a major commercial airport. And so this is something where, again, you have some benefits. I should note, it does note on there other land uses, office, residential, recreational. I'll note that not all freight hubs or villages have residential or recreational uses, but those that do try to maximize the benefits of having freight-related jobs nearby while minimizing the negative impact of the freight-oriented development on the community. And this next slide just shows a picture of the Alliance, Texas freight hub site or freight village site. And just a note on here, you can probably see some of the roadways that are on there. And at least Union Pacific Railroad, one of the major railroads in the U.S., is located. You can see that's labeled over on the right-hand side of the slide. Moving on to the next livability core principle, coordinating policies and leveraging investment. You can see, again, the definition there. It's basically trying to get bang for the buck by getting more funding sources, of public and private funding sources, to increase collaboration and get more bang for the buck. And this has there's a consistency between the livability core principle and freight transportation when you're talking about coordinating policies and leveraging investment. There's an increasing number of freight-focused projects that are utilizing private-public partnerships to obtain funding necessary to implement projects that will benefit freight transportation. There's also many public-public partnerships, or there can be multiple public sources along with multiple private sources in terms of finding the funds to implement freight transportation improvements. It can also be in-kind services as part of that. By having all the different players at the table, it shows the importance of those projects. Many people understand the importance. And some of these freight-oriented projects can actually also provide ancillary livability benefits. On this slide here, we have just an example. Again, this is Chicago CREATE project. For those of you who aren't familiar with CREATE, which stands for Chicago Region Environmental and Transportation Efficiency Program, the CREATE program is an effort in the Chicago area to basically reduce conflict, especially on the rail side, between passenger rail and freight rail, reducing at-grade intersections between those two. It also is really focused on reducing the number of at-grade crossings on the roadway side with rail. And with this project, there was a great need that was identified by various different stakeholders, the federal, state, and local levels, and also by the railroads themselves, actually the freight roads and the passenger railroads. METRA is the commuter rail agency in the Chicago area. They've all contributed funding. You can see on the slide here, they've contributed funding to making these improvements. And you're getting more bang for the buck. You're getting greater benefits because different players, different entities are at the table providing funding for necessary needs that have been previously identified. This next slide just shows you where some of these improvements are located. And you can see that some of the kinds of improvements on the different corridors, mainly freight separations, rail-rail separations, or highway rail separations, some grade crossing, safety improvements, various improvements that are meant to really help enhance both freight transportation and passenger transportation within the Chicago area. So that provides not only freight benefits, but also livability benefits, enhancing freight passenger transportation. Okay, we'll move on to the next livability core principles, which is providing more transportation choices. And this is, again, something where there's a consistency between freight transportation and livability. And the key here is that to note that USDOT's objective to support freight movement on the most energy efficient, environmentally sustainable mode for as long as possible. It should be noted that many freight movements, by their very nature, often require or are best served by intermodal solutions, although, as I noted earlier, almost all freight will be shipped by truck for at least the last mile or last few miles of the shipment. There can be opportunities where providing more transportation choices can provide mutual benefits for both freight and passenger transportation, which enhances both freight movements and livability. So it's about, again, having that right mix, both on the freight side and it's consistent with livability, on the freight side, having that proper mix provides benefits for freight transportation and can provide some benefits for livability as well. And just note here with the example, I'll go back to the Chicago CREATE project, a specific example. the Englewood Flyover. That's on the south side of Chicago. It's a rail-to-rail separation between two very active rail lines, one of which is a basically a freight rail line that handles Norfolk Southern traffic, about 46 NS trains a day. It also handles about 14 Amtrak trains a day for intercity passenger rail, creating a great separation between that line and also a basically a commuter rail line that handles Metro, 78 trains per day. That provides some passenger and freight mobility benefits, reduces congestion, helps reduce emissions, and improve air quality. And then this slide here just shows you a diagram in terms of where this is located. If you look at the picture at the top of the slide, it's sort of the actual separation is near the center of that, just to the right of center below and below the center point of where the separation is. You can see a diagram on there of what it looks like. Okay, that wraps up my presentation, and I want to thank you again for letting me talk about freight mobility. I'll take questions at the end.
Okay, well, thank you, Chip. Our next presentation is going to be given by Dwayne Fitzgerald of Coca-Cola. And if Dwayne, if you give me a second here, you can go ahead and get started.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, wherever you may be. My name is Dwayne Fitzgerald, and thank you, Jennifer, for the introduction. And thank you, Chip, for the wonderful information that we received previously. I want to talk a little bit about our delivery process and how we live the day-to-day situations, that some of the things Chip talked about, and not only sustainable communities, but just in the everyday lives. And, you know, to start off with, to let you know, Coca-Cola strives to be a good neighbor to the earth and an excellent corporate citizen. And, you know, at the same time, we're in business to put a product out, so we have to be very very concerned and open and listen to everyone's ideas, and we want to do what's the right thing for everybody. And let you know a little bit about who we are. We're the world's largest producer and distributor of non-alcoholic beverages, sold in 200 plus countries, 1.7 billion servings per day. And that's quite a large number, and that large number requires a large fleet of trucks on the road and out in our communities. Every day, you see our trucks visible. We're just rolling billboards all around your city. So, over the years, we have consolidated some of the local bottlers. One of the things that's helped reduce some traffic on the road, and we have reduced our amount of trucks and amount of deliveries that are out there at one time, but at the same time, we've increased the amount of product we're selling. Well, how have we done that? And that's some of the things I'll get to later in some of the optimization areas that we have done. That's part of being that good citizen, is to keep as many trucks off the road as we can and still enhance our deliveries. Just in the southeast region, to kind of make it, to bring you down from a 50,000 feet view to about a 5,000 feet view, the area that I am concerned with in the dispatching, from our Atlanta office, we operate in six states. We deliver almost 1 million cases a day, and we have 1,100 delivery routes on the road just in the southeast United States. Over the years, our vehicles have improved. We went from the horse and buggy days, from my grandfather started, to the open trucks, and to a truck like you see on the right side of that slide. But at the same time, and this is just a 44-year view of the downtown connector in Atlanta, for any of you that are familiar with that, quite a change. As you can see on the left, there is more traffic going southbound 85 now in 2011 than there was on the entire downtown connector in both lanes 44 years ago. And if it's changed that much in 44 years, what is it going to look like by 2050? Probably a pretty scary view if we don't start talking about some of these things now. And that's why we want to be in on the ground floor of some of these discussions. We want to create collaborations and partnerships with folks like the Department of Transportation. You'll hear later from a gentleman from the Atlanta Regional Commission, who we partnership with quite often, and so we can help and give some input. I'll refer back to the slide that Chip showed on the sidewalk. That's a pretty common scene in Atlanta and probably in your city as well. why should we be concerned with that? We may not be able to change the past, but we can certainly help design the future. And that's where some of these collaborations between companies like ours and other folks will help give that input. Yes, we want to see the sustainable communities strive and go forward, but at the same time, they have to have deliveries to be able to survive. And all of us do our good deed to be that great neighbor to the earth and to these sustainable communities at the same time, while we can stay in business. So with that said, what is our process? Customers place their orders through a salesperson or by phone. The orders are transmitted electronically to a central dispatch location. That part of it is my area. It comes into my team of 30 folks, and the dispatchers view these orders for a particular distribution center and determine the best mode of delivery. Orders are optimized by some proprietary software that we have, and it bases its decisions on customer delivery time windows, geography, workload for the driver. We have lots of little things. If everyone could accept a delivery 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, our job would be easy, and there probably wouldn't be a need for me at that point because everything would be almost automatic. But at the same time, when you sprinkle in the next ingredient, which is traffic, especially for Atlanta and some of the larger metro areas just in the southeast region, traffic is somewhat seems to be worse in some, if you can imagine it being worse in Atlanta, anywhere else in the South. I've experienced that in a couple other places I've visited, and everybody has their own challenges with that. So we use all this information, and we optimize it with that software to say, okay, here is what we have to do today. Here's the task at hand, and here's how long it should take. We complete those routes, send them out to distribution centers throughout, and they're loaded on a truck, and then the driver comes in the next day and delivers what we have dispatched. What challenges does the driver face on that? Customer time windows. That's the biggest one we face. We can only deliver to our customers during the times they specify. For any number of reasons, I'll give you an example, a large grocery store chain that may only have a receiver. They have a receiver that specifically just receives loads from other vendors, just like Coke, milk, bread, potato chips, what have you. And their entire job is spent, their day is spent receiving those orders and verifying those invoices that come in. So they have certain times that those folks can work. That's one of the big obstacles. Traffic congestion is a challenge, obviously. Any number of things can happen that takes that driver off course and in danger of missing delivery times. And once he's missed one, the rest of his day is probably downhill from there. He's probably going to miss all the rest of them because of the first one. Accessibility. There are areas that do not allow deliveries within time ranges. We have one over near Piedmont Park in Atlanta. We have a grocery store that we cannot deliver to until after 9 a.m. in the morning because of the residents don't like to hear the backup alarms on the trucks. Point taken. We're going to stay out of there before 9 o'clock a.m. Pedestrian-friendly areas. We have areas that are within those zones. Makes it very difficult to deliver. A couple of examples of those. University of Georgia in Athens. They're moving to more of a pedestrian and walk, and I think it's a great thing, but at the same time, we have to design a way to get deliveries to keep those places functioning. University of Auburn, exact same situation. They, just in the 4 years that we've been recruiting dispatchers from their logistics program, I've saw three major thoroughfares that cars could drive through, closed just in 4 years. And it's pretty obvious the direction they're going. Not saying it's a bad thing, but we have to have a plan to get around that at the same time. On that point, one of the things that we've done, we partnership with Athens-Clarke County government about 8 years ago on a situation, and what made me think of this, I actually hadn't planned on talking about it, Chip's slide about the curbside delivery. Downtown Athens, very much like any other downtown area, especially with a large major college in the area, very busy, very full of activity, pedestrians, bicycle traffic, and cars. We have many, many different types of delivery vehicles that are downtown Athens. So their challenge was, how do we do this and not shut down all the parking for the folks that are trying to go in and buy? Because it was sort of a battle every Thursday, it seemed like, especially. So we first started by trying to collaborate with some of the other vendors to pick different days and say, okay, we're going to try to deliver downtown Monday if you guys will come on Tuesday. Well, that sounds great, but when it comes to real life with your customers, I'll give you an example of a bar specifically in a college town. There's quite a few in Athens, and we'll say, well, we want to deliver at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday, and they think we've lost our mind because they probably just, if it's any other day than Monday, they probably just closed at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning the night before. They're not going to be there at 8 to accept the delivery. So that worked okay for about a week, and then everything sort of fell apart, and all the trucks wound up back downtown at the same time. So what we've done is we said, okay, what about the middle lanes? Athens is lucky enough to have, on the one-way streets and the major thoroughfares, they have three lanes of traffic going one way. So what they've done is designated the middle lane as delivery zones, actually painted some little red lines, and rather than taking up parking from folks who's going to be consumers, we park in those middle lanes, and you would think, first off, oh my God, that would be a safety hazard, but it's really worked well. And that's one of the cities that I think if you ever have a chance to visit on issues like this and how do you deliver to downtowns, how do you cure the traffic ills, and these trucks are parked everywhere, that's certainly a model to look at, because they have done a very good job at that. What actions have we taken to help, other than the example that I just gave you on Athens? Alternative deliveries. We've implemented night deliveries where possible in non-peak traffic hours. That has been a must-do in some of our tourist areas. For any of you that are familiar with Destin, Florida, between Pensacola and Valparaiso, those two distribution centers for us cover that area. And it is just absolutely a non-event to try to deliver during the daylight hours during tourist season. So we've been lucky enough to get 90% of our deliveries are made at night. It does another thing we found out, there's an added incentive on that because the drivers love it a lot more, not just because of the reduced traffic. It's a lot cooler in Destin, Florida at night than it is in the daytime. So that's worked out well. We've done that other places. We continue to try to make alternative deliveries at all of our distribution centers when possible. Geographic optimization. We've aligned our delivery days to deliver accounts in high traffic areas on the same day. Just name any busy metropolitan road in your area that you're in now, and you can probably all think of a road that you hate to go at lunch to eat at a restaurant on that road, but you can't make a left-hand turn, it seems like. It's just so crowded. Well, we saw that too. So what we see is if we can get most of our deliveries made in 1 or 2 days, sometimes it's possible, sometimes it's not. Of course, it's all due to the volume of that store, and we're certainly not going to turn down a delivery to someone who's wanting our product. But if we can make it happen rather than going 5 days a week and delivering five stores each time we go, well, if we can get 12 on one day and 13 on another, hooray for all of us. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, but it certainly keeps a truck off of the road on a different day. Sales route optimization. We've aligned the sales routes by geography as well so that we know we're not going there. Everything we sell is pre-sold, either through phone or by advanced sales method. So we know we're not going to just be inadvertently riding up and down a road that we don't need to be on. Delivery vehicle optimization. We've replaced older, less efficient vehicles with rear load, unload trailers. I'll show you an example of that on a few slides later. And that's resulted in fewer deliveries on the road. Well, how can that be if it's truck for truck? Our trucks may only be 5, 6, 7 foot longer than what the truck was before, but it's a little bit taller. So the footprint on the road, the actual footprint of that truck, is taking up the same or just a little bit more than what it was. It's still a lot more than having two of those footprint for foot. footprint on the road at two different days. And as these older units life cycle out, we're replacing those in addition with hybrid clean fuel vehicles and some hybrid electric vehicles. We have over 100 of those in the Atlanta area right now, and they're working out really well. A little hesitant about a hybrid electric truck pulling a load as large as that, but it's the technology is there, and I'd encourage any of you to look at that if you're thinking about replacing any kind of your fleet, even for local governments. Look at the hybrid electric; it will really surprise you. There's some amazing technology there now. GPS devices. We're utilizing a GPS device just in the initial stages of this, because it took several years to develop what we want it to do. We want to do more than say, I know where this truck is, or this truck is a dot on a radar map. That blip needs to equate into some data. What we've done is we've used that blip on the radar screen to track the data of the speed, travel time, and that helps us better understand traffic patterns and assist in planning our route of delivery. If 10 days in a row, or 10 deliveries in a row, we sent this driver at a specific time, and he is taking an hour and 15 minutes, and then by chance we decide, you know what? What if we switch and just reverse all of his deliveries today, and we're going to send him to his last stop first? Just inadvertently switch it up and try a different time. Sometimes we find out it takes longer. Sometimes it takes less. And what we try to do is keep tweaking that system until we've found the sweet spot, so to speak. And then we use that data so that when we are dispatching that particular outlet, the data is out there to say if we're going to send the driver, and he's scheduled to be there between 8 and 9 a.m., a warning pops up to say, are you sure you really want to send this driver at this time? You know, it's indicating that if you waited an hour to go, you would save 15 minutes in traffic. And those are all tools that are at our disposal right now. So that's been some really good and exciting stuff. We still have a long way to go in finishing developing that. But just to give you a little idea of what we're doing, here's the slide showing you the difference I was talking about in those older vehicles. The picture at the top is what we call side load. It has the doors on the side. There's still quite a few of those out there in the business. There are some smaller straight trucks that aren't combination side load type. And in smaller areas, for example, New Orleans and the French Quarter, we're not allowed, nor is any company allowed, to take a combination vehicle in the French Quarter. So some restrictions like that have dictated that we have to keep some of those side loads alive. But the picture at the bottom is a 35-foot trailer, and the trailer top, just so you know, is 27 foot long, so it's an 8-foot difference. But we can almost deliver out of that one trailer what it would take going two times on the top trailer. So for that 8-foot difference, the 8 foot's worth it to keep that truck off the road twice. And the tractor is basically the same size, it's the same GVW. Everything about those are the same except one key indicator, and of course I put our nicest, newest, shiniest truck at the bottom, which happens to be a hybrid electric truck that we're using. That's just one of the many that we have on the road right now in Atlanta. And again, as we life cycle those out, you know, to help with the emissions and our entire carbon footprint that we're emitting, we want to reduce that as well. So not only are we taking that truck off the road, we're taking some emissions out of the air as well, and hopefully all that will equate to a lot less traffic on the road and be able to help our sustainable communities in the future. And that's all I have. And I want to thank you for being patient with my presentation, and hope you've learned something. I'll take questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Dwayne. Looks like we got a lot of good questions there, and we'll get to those after our next presentation. Our final presentation will be given by Michael Cray from the Atlanta Regional Commission. And Michael, I will bring up your presentation. And you can go ahead.
All right, great. Thank you very much. It looks like it's time for round two for the Atlanta double play here. Thanks a lot for having me. I'm going to talk about a truck routing study that we did in Atlanta, and how we accounted for potential environmental justice impacts in that study. So first off, well, here's the agenda today. So we're going to talk about the truck route master plan, or as we like to call it, the AstroMap. and some of the reasons behind it, cross-regional travel, and then the methodology that we use to analyze the environmental justice impacts. So here we have a overview of the Atlanta MPO region. My agency, for transportation purposes, encompasses all or part of 18 counties. In the center in the blue, you see the city of Atlanta. And the important to note is the interstate network, which works very well. And the interstates carry the majority of the truck movements in the region. But there are some issues. And when we did a previous freight study in 2005, as part of our stakeholder outreach, we found a need for cross-regional mobility, something other than the interstate network. And what I'm talking about here is if you divide the region into quadrants, and for example, you wanted to go from the northwest quadrant to the southwest quadrant from the city of Cartersville down to the city of Newnan, for example, the only way to do that very efficiently is to get on the interstate, come down to the more congested area, and go around the perimeter of I-285 and shoot back down I-85. That's a little bit circuitous and not a direct shot. Similarly, there is not a good way to go from the northwest to the northeast. You have to utilize the interstate network, come down and go back up. So what we were looking to address with our truck route master plan was cross-regional mobility, access for trucks to major freight destinations. We also wanted to provide redundancy to the interstate network in case, you know, something happens, I mean, a flood or accident. We wanted to have good alternatives to that network. So we started off with an initial network from our previous study that I mentioned in 2005. This is what we back then we called our regional priority freight highway network, the RPFHN. And in transportation, we like to use a lot of acronyms that's a good one there. But this was a network that was just done really with planner's judgment. There wasn't any real vetting of the network with the industry or any analytical analysis. And we wanted to take that network and see if see how that worked for both truck routing and then how that impacted our environmental justice populations. So that's the transportation network that we analyze. And when the other thing too that we took into account was the land use alongside within a half a mile of the roadway network. For land use planners, this is a pretty typical land use color scheme. But I wanted to put it up here for reference and show a database that we have at the Atlanta Regional Commission. This is what it's our LandPro database, and it has land use classifications for all the parcels in our 18 county planning area, plus two additional counties. So we've got a 20 county region here that shows the land use, and with the land use, we can get an idea of the intensity of the freight generation in the area. And this is important to note here. When a lot of times when you talk to not just citizens but a lot of planners in general, when you talk about freight, you tend to think of industrial uses, warehouses, manufacturing centers, distribution centers, things like that. And those are a lot of people think that those are the only places that actually generate truck traffic. Well, this slide illustrates the major industrial areas in the Atlanta region, and if this were all we had to plan for, it would be relatively easy. It's a relatively easy concentration of areas that you could design or assign a roadway network to accommodate those. But when you look at freight generation by land use, it's really much more than just those industrial uses. Any commercial area is going to generate a lot of traffic. I mean, when you talk about Coca-Cola, they're not, you know, delivering to the manufacturing locations, they're delivering to commercial retail outlets. So any commercial land use, industrial, transportation areas like the airport or railroad, rail yards, things like that are going to generate freight traffic, truck traffic. In addition, agricultural uses are going to generate truck traffic. So when you take all of the real truck-generating land uses and you map it, this is what it looks like for the Atlanta region. And you see here, it's much more spread out and more difficult to find an optimum network for this. So in regards to environmental justice planning, these are the areas we have to try to accommodate for truck routing, but we also have to see if environmental justice populations are going to be present in these areas, and if we can and try to avoid those if possible. So by environmental justice in the Atlanta region, we have defined it by poverty and race, and then for the purposes of our truck route study, we also added age. The reason we added age is because the particulate matter spewed by diesel engines tends to affect the young developing lungs and older lungs more so than the typical population. So we looked at poverty, race, and age. And we looked again at those populations within a half mile of that original regional priority freight highway network. What this slide illustrates is the percentages of block groups in that buffer area that had some sort of environmental justice presence. Okay, so if you look through the 18 county region, you see some pretty high percentages here. To the core of the region, we're approaching 100%. So what that tells you right off the bat is that you're going to have difficulty avoiding any sort of environmental justice impact. So since you can't avoid it, you're going to have to tend to go to mitigation. You're really going to have to be affecting things at the margin. So the methodology that was used to analyze whether or not to analyze the environmental justice impacts, was really environmental justice presence and freight intensity. And if you look at this matrix here, as you move from the left to the right, you have increasing freight intensity. And if you move from the bottom to the top, you have increasing environmental justice presence. So when you look at the bottom right box there, the imbalanced non-EJ, what that means is that you've got high freight-intensive land use, some industrial area or commercial areas, a combination thereof, with no environmental justice presence. So in a perfect world, that would be where you want to send all of your trucks, because you're going to be able to provide access to those intensive freight areas, and you're going to be able to avoid environmental justice populations. Now, that doesn't always happen. The boxes to the left are low freight intensity, and those are going to be the easiest to remove from the network. So if you have a route going through this air through an area with low freight intensity, if there's a viable alternative, you may want to choose that because that route isn't really providing access. It's providing the transit through the area. And finally, the top right box here, the imbalanced environmental justice, that is where you have your conflicts. You've got high intensity, freight generating land use, and you've got environmental justice concerns. So this is where you put your you start talking about mitigation, because it's going to be difficult to remove the route, but you're going to have vulnerable populations around that truck route. And these are the environmental justice categories. As you go from the number 1 to 7, you've got more groups that are affected. So if you're in a 7 here, you've got 3 different racial groups and poverty present. And so you have a number of different environmental justice groups that can possibly be affected. And so what we did is we looked at the census block groups with the environment, with this environmental justice demographic information, and we're able to pull out those trouble areas. This is an example from Barrow County, which is actually a rural county in the Atlanta region. And when you look at the census block groups here, that the column with the colors shows whether or not there's a presence of that environmental justice conflict. If there's nothing there, then there's no environmental justice conflict. And when you take all the census block groups in Barrow County, you've got a number of routes that had that troublesome imbalanced EJ category. State Route 8, State Route 11, 53, and 211. What that looks like spatially in Barrow County is really all of the analyzed truck routes in Barrow County. So this map here shows the land use in a half-mile buffer around all of the roadways that were analyzed. And in the case of Barrow County, unfortunately, there's really not a lot of alternatives. It's relatively rural. There isn't a lot of network density there. So again, we're talking about mitigation as opposed to avoidance of environmental justice concerns. And when our analysis was complete, the environmental justice analysis that went along with the network analysis, this is the final network that we came up with. There are 7 north-south routes in blue that you see there. These are all non-interstate arterial routes, mainly state routes. You've got 8 east-west corridors in red, and then you've got some important connector corridors in yellow that provide access to major freight generating areas. But those corridors don't go across the entire region. It's important, but they're not completely regional. So this network is what we're using as a policy tool for investing in freight improvements in the future. And in addition, you can use it to test how we did in a separate way. We've got this map here shows all the elementary schools within that 18 county MPO area, 519 total, along with that freight generating land use. So the elementary schools within a quarter mile of the that freight intensive land use, there's about 60% of or 306 out of all of the elementary schools are near that freight generating land use. What that means is that the students that go to those schools are going to be exposed to the particulate matter from trucks making deliveries, making pickups in that area. But you can take that and compare it to our truck route network and see how we've done, how we were able to do with avoiding those schools. And when you do a half-mile buffer around our final truck route network, you see we're only affecting 34% of the elementary schools. So at least in the transit, the kind of cross-regional mobility, if the trucks utilize these routes, they'll actually be affecting less schools than are within that freight-intensive land use. If you look on the kind of like the outlying areas, this also illustrates another issue that you have with trucks and community impacts, is that a lot of these state routes actually have schools located like right on them, because schools are making location decisions the same way a lot of businesses are: cheap land and adequate transportation access. You know, especially when you start getting out into maybe some of the newer developing areas that are having green-filled school development. So if you've got a school on a major route, it may be good for building the cost of building the school and getting kids there, but it could have negative air quality impacts on the students. And finally, this is a bit of a non sequitur, but I wanted to kind of reiterate the types of projects that we are looking to fund on this truck route network. And like Chip showed earlier, the chewed up sidewalk, we've got a number of projects identified in major freight areas, such as the one that's on this slide here. You've got trucks chewing up the shoulder. It's bad for deliveries. Shipper or carrier can have broken product. It's going to cost more to maintain that transportation network, and it's also a safety concern for pedestrians. If they're standing on that sidewalk right there and the trucks are cutting that corner, it could be a safety concern. But if you look at this, the total cost of this project is under $100,000. So if you were able to go in there, fund this project, and have adequate geometrics there to accommodate the trucks, you can do something for $100,000 that's going to benefit the transportation network and ultimately the users of the roadway and those who are buying the products delivered by the trucks. And with that, that is the end of my presentation, and be taking questions, I guess.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. We're actually going to move on to the question and answer now with the questions posted online, and I think what I'll do, Michael, is start with the questions for you, since you just wrapped up, as long as your presentation is fresh in everybody's minds.
Okay.
And so the first question is, how did ARC mitigate the freight EJ issue in Barrow County?
Well, in Barrow County, we were not able to have a alternative route chosen. So what we did is we worked with a couple different air quality partners in the Atlanta region, the Georgia Conservancy. They have a group called Mothers and Others for Clean Air, and we also worked with the Georgia EPD, Environmental Protection Division, to write in some recommendations into some air quality mitigation recommendations into the final recommendations of our study. You know, we didn't make any recommendations as far as like moving populations or anything like that, but it accounted for construction and future land use that could help with that population.
Okay. Can you please explain why a community that has poverty with differing race conflicts would be different in the analysis?
Well, you know, we just, okay. Could you repeat that question? Explain why
A community that has poverty with differing race conflicts will be different in the analysis.
So I'm assuming that would be different than a racial presence with no poverty. I'm going to take the question that way. Well, the reason we have that is that poverty, regardless of race, puts you in an environment or puts you in a vulnerable position. But with the federal regulations for environmental justice, we also take into consideration that many minority groups are often more adversely impacted by transportation and other things than non environmental justice groups. That is just showing what we try to do was show that it's more than one group being affected there. It wasn't necessarily a rank order, but we're trying to show more than one group.
And I guess that some clarification was typed in. Why would the community that has poverty with one race conflict be different than two race conflicts or three race conflicts?
Right. That's not necessarily. We weren't ranking them, saying that if there was only one race conflict, then that was okay, or then that was enough. It's just we just wanted to account for all the different communities, and we could have just said had a ranking system that I guess that said poverty, race, age, and that's it. But we decided to kind of just separate those all out. But it wasn't. We didn't rank them. It wasn't. Three was worse than one.
Okay. I'll ask one more question to you, and then I'm going to move on to the next presenter, even though we have a few more questions, just to make sure we have time to get through some questions for everybody. But did you incorporate interregional freight flows into the AstroMap analysis?
Yes, we did. We looked at truck numbers, and probably more importantly, what we were interested in is talking to the carriers and seeing what routes they were using. We did a lot of outreach. We actually talked with Coca-Cola, with Dwayne and his group extensively about what routes they used, what were the best routes, what were the ones to avoid. We had FAF data and Global Insights, the Transurge data available that we looked at those freight flows. But we weren't sticking strictly to those because we were also trying to figure out, okay, where do we want those flows to go in the future? We looked at the best roadways that could accommodate those in terms of the roadway characteristics like lane widths and travel speeds and things like that. And also, their access to freight-generating areas.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on to some questions for Chip next, and then we'll go to Dwayne, and then if we have time, we'll come back to the questions that are remaining for you, Michael. But let's see here. The first question is, I'm curious if President Obama's goal to double exports is by weight or value or what is it by? And any more information on this goal would be of interest.
Yeah, I think with from looking at the questions, I think that one of the other attendees addressed that or mentioned that was in a State of Union address. But I think that it was the intent was to have that be doubled by value was the focus on that.
Okay. What efforts, if any, does FHWA work with freight facilities to support local hiring in those communities that could be burdened by emissions, especially EJ communities from freight industry? Are those populations that live in large truck and rail areas employed in those jobs?
Yeah, I would say that with the issue of environmental justice communities or just in general employing local community residents at freight facilities, I think that generally speaking is more of a local or a regional issue. In terms of addressing that. And in terms of So, I mean, it may vary from location to location in terms of how that's being addressed. I would say in terms of current employment, there are some residents that live near the freight facilities. We'll just use the example of water ports. I think that's probably, at least for me, is one that's sort of easy to visualize. There are some residents that do work in those freight facilities that live in the communities adjacent to them, but I think many do not. I think what we've seen is that generally there is not as close of a tie as there used to be years ago between people working at freight facilities or working, we'll just say, at ports or rail yards or whatnot, and people living in communities. I think that going back many years ago, the transportation system, I'll say just generally speaking, but the transportation system maybe not being, I'm thinking like World War II, before that it wasn't as well developed. You had people live closer to where they work, and I don't think we have that quite as much now. I think there are some people that do live in those communities that work there, but I'd say that it's a relatively small number of people that do that.
This question was actually asked before you gave your slide on, I think, the freight village in Texas, but the question is, several cities have talked about creating freight villages, but I have not found any that have been implemented. Are you aware of any? And I know that Howie Mann from the NYMTC provided a link to their report that listed some villages, but Chip, I'll open it up to you if anything else that you're aware of.
Sure. There's a couple that, besides the Alliance Texas example, that I'm at least somewhat familiar with. I wouldn't say I'm overly familiar with them. But one would be, I believe this is what's considered to be a freight village, is called, I believe it's called Center Point, which is out in the Chicago area near Joliet, Illinois. That's one location that's being developed. I think that's actually a facility where there's actually, many of you probably that are on the call realize that Chicago is an area where you have a lot of the major freight railroads. They have some of their hubs there. All the freight railroads have their hubs there. So that's a site that, or a location where there would be I think Center Point being one of the examples where they could have a freight village. I think Center Point is considered a freight village. Another one, which I'm not sure if with Howie's study, because it's in the New York metro area, that I don't know if it would be considered a freight village, at least according to the study you did, but would be, I think it would be best described being the Perth Amboy area, which is a little bit south of New York City. It's in New Jersey, Perth Amboy, New Jersey, near where the Outer Bridge connects New Jersey with Staten Island. There's a freight facility or freight village there, although I don't know if there's any residential development as part of that. I do know that there's definitely multimodal freight access at that particular facility. So those are a couple I'm at least somewhat familiar with. But I would recommend that the study that that Howie did for NIMTEC, I think, would probably be a particularly good source to get information, since they've rounded up that information.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chip. Sure. I think now we'll move on to some questions for Dwayne. And let's see here. First question is, what role does Coca-Cola have in ensuring truck operators follow local idling ordinances intended to improve air quality?
Well, I guess the short answer for that is we follow whatever ordinance, if there are towns or ordinances, and obviously the new clean diesels that we're replacing. Those are all certified clean idle vehicles, so we're following any local ordinance on idling.
Okay, thank you. I know we have a question from Abby in there. I'm going to come back to that and put that out to all presenters in a few minutes. But the next question specific to Coke is, does Coke participate in any freight stakeholder working groups or freight planning committees?
Absolutely, and as Michael said, he worked with us and we've worked with him. The Atlanta Regional Commission is one that we have and gave our input on, and we would obviously be interested in helping out anyone else that we could if you have needs in your area.
Okay. What percent of Coke's deliveries are made in the off hours?
That is something I do not know. I couldn't give you a number percent-wise, but I would, if I had to, based on my knowledge in the Southeast, I would have to say that it's about 15%, and that's just a wild guess, but it's going to be somewhere under 25%, I know.
Okay. And does Coke have a policy on raising the gas tax, similar to General Motors CEO, who suggested a $1 a gallon increase to encourage use of alternative fuels, electric vehicles, transit, walkability?
Nothing that I'm aware of. I've not heard any information of a position at all that we have on the gas tax.
Do customers who accept off-peak hour deliveries receive a discount?
No, and I saw that question. That's probably a good idea. That is, we have not approached that to any of our customers yet, but there's certainly things like that are certainly things that we could carry to our customers and see how receptive they would be to it.
Okay. I'll ask you this next question, but Chip or Michael, I'll invite you to jump in as well. And I guess this, you know, first from Coke's standpoint, can you name two cities in the U.S. that have done a good job of providing truck routes to deliver consumer goods to their residents? And I'm particularly interested in examples where they have worked through conflicts.
From Coke's standpoint, unfortunately, I can't say that those cities exist. That they're probably very well could be there, and I'm not aware of them, but I couldn't name you two examples where someone's did a really good job of planning that ahead.
Okay. The one that, this is Michael Craig, the one that I know about is New York City. They have a, they've created their own truck route network, and it's pretty extensive. And there was a lot of the, you know, the stuff that they had to go through with, you know, people saying we don't want trucks through here, we don't, you know, because I don't know many people who live in neighborhoods that want trucks coming through their neighborhoods. So I know New York did a good job with that.
Okay, thank you.
I was just going to say, I think, Mike, you can probably toot your own horn a little bit. I think, although it may not be necessarily directly answering the question, I think that the effort that Atlanta Regional Commission did in terms of identifying truck routes is maybe not exactly what is being asked in the question, but I think it does definitely touch on that in terms of trying to identify where the key truck routes are based on the needs within the region. So I think that Atlanta might be considered an example as well.
And we did have to work through some issues too. We did do quite a bit of public outreach as well as industry outreach. And particularly in the city of Atlanta, there were some neighborhoods that we had to work with and to accommodate them and accommodate the trucks. And we were able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Back to Dwayne, what is Coke's position relative to truck-only toll lanes?
Don't know that we have a position on that. That's something that's really in our region. I guess formally being talked about for the past maybe year or so around this area, and I can't say that we have a position on that either way. We're obviously just up to if that's what it requires, and that's the best thing for everyone overall, I think we would probably support that.
Okay, thank you. How does Coke allocate time for each delivery differently by the density of the area served? Is it more time allocated per delivery for dense environments or more rural environments?
It is more time for the more urban environments, and the way we do that within the software that predictively tells what a driver's route should be that day, we slow the truck speed down rather than going at it. We have a set miles per hour which is very reduced from the posted speed limit. For instance, if the posted speed limit within the city of Atlanta was 45, we're probably going to drop that on an average about 10 miles per hour. And then we start from that as a base, and that's 100% of speed. But if it's a very, very, very dense area and we've experienced problems there and we already have knowledge of that, we might drop it to 75% of our speed, not the posted limit. So we reduce the speed that truck will go on paper by those factors.
Okay. Next question is, off-peak hour delivery is advantageous to the customer as well as most. This is also their off-peak hour. On the other hand, they probably have less staff and might not be able to leave the front of the store to accept the delivery. How do most businesses deal with this security issue? And Dwayne, I don't know if you can answer that from Coke's standpoint, but then also Chip and Michael, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, from our end of it, I mean, that security is always an issue to the stores. That is one of the reasons that some of the major retailers don't want to have someone in their store just to receive a few. But what we found is most of the places that we are able to get that off-peak hour delivery in is in a more dense, more well-lighted, more populous area, and it all depends on the volume of that store. If that store is very busy all the time, they're going to have a need to have more employees there at night as well. So it works out to where they already have people on staff. But that is certainly one of the concerns, one of the reasons that we don't have more customers on that.
For Michael, any thoughts?
I mean, not really. My understanding of off-peak deliveries is all about the shipper. It's about who's getting the deliveries. It's not about the carrier. It's not, you know, Coke's not the one who is deciding when they're going to deliver it. It's who's going to do it. So, but I don't know anything about the safety of it.
Yeah, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about specific examples. But my understanding is that there are some receivers, some stores that may have secured areas in terms of allowing off-peak deliveries, that they don't necessarily have to have staff or at least as many staff on duty to receive the deliveries. I don't know about specific examples though.
Okay. I'm gonna actually go back up here to a question that was posted and kind of open it up to all three presenters to give us your thoughts, and actually this might be more Michael and Chip than anything else, but one special challenge we're seeing in built-out New England is complaints about freight locomotive idling near established residents due to increased track congestion. Inadequate capacity in yards, locomotives not equipped with automatic engine start-stop technology, and crew understaffing. Locomotives are idling for days and weekends, regardless of season, in absence of crew, mainly to obviate need to perform four-hour brake tests upon startup. More public and private funding for loco AESS, sidetrack rehab construction, and yard expansion would help, but money is scarce. Any ideas?
Well, this.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say I don't necessarily have specific ideas. I would say, and this might be stuff that you already know, but one of the challenges there is that when you're talking about freight rail. That it's all, the freight for the railroads are privately almost, well, all the major railroads and most of the smaller railroads are privately owned. So it makes it a little more difficult in terms of trying to, to say, well, this is what you need to do in terms of, reducing idling and whatnot. I do know that some railroads are looking into developing alternative power or hybrid engines to reduce emissions, although I know that those engines, I think their intent is to try to operate them mainly in their rail yards for rail yard movements. I also know that many railroads are looking to continue to focus on enhancing their infrastructure in areas where there is needs for infrastructure in terms of moving their trains. Although that may not necessarily address the idling issue either. I would say that in terms of trying to address that issue. It could be something where the community, and mind you, I know in some cases it may be difficult, but if the community identifies that as being a problem, to try to reach out to the railroads or the railroad that's in question here, to try to engage them on this issue, just to discuss this and talk about some of the challenges, some of the concerns that they have about the idling, and maybe in some cases the railroads obviously are. They're focused on trying, as was noted in the question, to try to, I guess you could say, reduce costs. But I think if it's brought, made a higher visibility as being an issue, and working with the railroads, the community working with the railroads, it could probably be the likelihood of being able to address the issue goes up. I don't know if that's a sufficient answer, but...
Well, in the Atlanta region, we have been using CMAQ money. CMAQ is a federal funding category. It's congestion mitigation and air quality funding. And it's got a very specific, it's actually pretty flexible, but it has to have some sort of air quality benefit. And what we've been doing is taking that money and letting the railroads purchase a genset technology, which is it's a cleaner technology for the trains, especially like in the switching yards. You know, you have the small engines that are switching trains and making trains and such. Those are generator powered as opposed to diesel powered, or at least they're dual, so they're have much less air quality impacts. So we've been using that funding category to help the railroads purchase those engines. So that might be something that could be done.
Okay. Another question for all presenters. How do you propose to reconcile potential conflicts between pedestrian needs with truck traffic needs?
I'll take a stab at that one. This is something that we definitely we're very concerned with our truck route network, and you know, we have a very strong pedestrian coalition here in Atlanta. Although you might not think it's the most pedestrian-friendly area, we do have a very strong advocacy group. First off, I will say that I don't think that accommodating trucks is, you know, exclusive to accommodating pedestrians. You can make a safe crossing for pedestrian at the same time accommodate trucks. For example, if you do have to increase the turning radii, you can have if it makes it a longer crossing, you can have pedestrian refuge islands. And in some cases, like the one the example that I showed and the one that Chip showed, if there were pedestrians standing on that sidewalk while the trucks were turning, it wouldn't be unheard of if a pedestrian could get clipped by a trailer or something like that. So when you increase the turning radii and get the pedestrian out of the way, it can make it safer. Now, it doesn't necessarily make it a shorter, easier crossing for pedestrian, but you can make it safe. And I think we're very concerned with the fact that, you know, we're talking about a very limited set of roadways that are generally larger roadways that are have really been built for, you know, throughput of auto traffic. And we're not talking about, you know, increasing turning radii at, you know, all sorts of side streets and collector streets in neighborhoods and in downtown and things like that. I think if you do it in a rational, measured way and accommodate the safety of the pedestrian, you can do it. But that's my two cents.
I was going to say, I think that the issue, the question about how do you reconcile that, Michael gave a good answer to that in terms of, you know, there's different ways you can mitigate it, you can increase safety. What I would add is I think having an understanding of where you're going to have your truck movements. The idea that you don't have to have every street or every road designed in such a way that's going to have, if you're going to have, you know, that those, especially in more urban areas, I would say, where you don't have very much truck traffic, it's side streets. It's streets that aren't going to handle truck traffic, you know, on a very rarely or never, pretty much. I mean, those streets, I don't think you need to necessarily design those streets to be so wide to accommodate trucks, because trucks aren't going to operate in those streets. The streets that are major or more significant commercial quarters in terms of, if you're talking about, you know, commercial development, you know, stores and whatnot, where there's a lot more deliveries. Obviously, if you're talking about industrial development, if you're talking about roadways that host those kinds of uses, I think it's important then to be sensitive to understanding what kind of truck volumes are actually existing, get a better handle on that, and get a sense of what the needs may be just based on existing truck traffic patterns, and doing some observation, maybe doing some outreach in some cases to some of the carriers that may operate on those streets, if that is something that's feasible and it's can readily identify some of the trucks that operate on those roadways. So it's really, I think it's about being sensitive, being aware of what kind of existing truck volumes there are on different roadways, and making sure you properly design your roads or properly design your streets based on the existing land uses, which are really what's generating, quite frankly, that's what's generating the truck traffic. So being aware of that and being appropriate and being sensitive to that in your design, I think it goes a significant way. It doesn't necessarily fully solve every problem, but I think that does address the problem in a way that makes a good deal of sense.
Thank you. Dwayne, just give you a chance. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to that?
I'd have to concur with Michael and Chip on that. And, you know, the only thing I would add is that, and both of them hit on this point, is that it all begins with education. Too many times when people aren't educated on the whole scope of this and the whole idea, and when you explain these things to them, they have that aha moment and say, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But when we educate folks, for the first thing that most of the general public would probably say when they saw either one of those two roads we were talking about is, oh my God, you need to ban trucks from there. That's always the first initial response, and that's not the correct response. As Michael said, you know, maybe our first priority should make it safe. If it makes it more difficult for the truck to make that turn, well, so be it. We have to have it safe first. That's the first thing. We get that out of the way. Stop the bleeding, so to speak, and then we work on improving it. And if that means it could be that we both are giving up something, maybe the truck has to go, you know, 300 feet more to make a hard turn that's more difficult, but at least now those pedestrians are safe. And I believe education, whether it be a partnership, public-private, or a three-fold through government, local governments, cities, communities, state, federal level as well, between public and private, you know, workshops offer some information out there when roads are being redesigned and rebuilt to say, this is what we have in mind, and give the public a chance to see that. And hopefully that will be some of the education that they need to say, oh, we've got to make this sustainable for both.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're about out of time. I know we still have a few unanswered questions, and I'll attempt to get some written responses from the presenters that will be sent out with the follow-up information. But thank you, everybody, for all your great questions, and thank you to our three presenters for three very interesting presentations. I will send out an email once the recording from today, the transcript, and the presentations are available online. The next seminar will be held on July 20th and will be on freight facility impact fees. The seminar is not yet available for registration. Hopefully it will be in the next few days, and I'll send out a notice through the freight planning listserv once it is available. As a reminder, if you are an AICP member and you're applying for certification maintenance credits for today, the seminar is not yet listed on the AICP website, but I will also send out an email to everybody who registered once it is available. So with that, thank you, everybody. I encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so, as that's how we advertise most of these seminars. Thank you to all three presenters, and everybody enjoy the rest of your day.